The following shiur is delivered by Dayan Shlomo Cohen, Dayan in Beit Din Ahavat Shalom in Yerushalayim, and author of Pure Money, as part of the Parasha and Halakha audio series, a project of the Sephardic Halakha Center.
Parashat Vayishlach. In this week's Parsha, Yaakov Avinu, after his meeting with Esav, comes to Shechem. There he camped and built a mizbeach. Says the Posuk that he bought the land where he made his camp from Bnei Hamor Avi Shechem. And the Torah even tells us the price that he paid for that piece of land. The Gemara in Masechet Baba Batra, Daf Nun Dalit, tells us an interesting problem that can arise when a Jew buys land from a goy. Even though the sale of land is normally completed with a cash payment, nevertheless, in a place where the custom is to write a shtar, a contract, to prove that you've bought the land, no sale of land is complete without a shtar. The question here is a question of gemirut daat, seeing as no purchase can be complete unless each side is satisfied and sure that there's been a valid deal has been done. In our times, certainly, people will not rely on a purchase of real estate unless they have something written, either a written contract or the land registered in their name. That's what would really be in the place of a contract in our times. No one would buy real estate today without knowing that it's going to be registered in their name. So in our times, this is certainly true, that when anyone who buys real estate is going to want solid proof that they are in fact the owner of that land. And they would not rely on their purchase. They would not be gomer bedatam to finish the purchase until they know that it's registered officially in their name. You must remember that this is not necessarily going to be the contract of sale that's drawn up between the two parties, the buyer and the seller. Right? That's normally a contract setting out the details of how we're going to finish the deal, what are the dates for payments are going to be, when there's going to be a transfer of ownership. It's not necessarily, you have to check the wording in any particular case, but it's not necessarily proof of ownership. Proof of ownership would normally be after the sale has been completed, when the property, when the real estate is officially registered in the name of the buyer. Sometimes possession is going to be given over before the property is registered in the name of the new buyer. And once the keys have been given over and the new buyer has moved in and can start making improvements and can start changing the locks. So once he can do that, then even if the property has not yet been registered in his name, that would be a final change of ownership, says the Ramor. And it would make a tremendous, tremendous nafgamina if, chas v'sholom, if God forbid there were to be a tornado that were to destroy the house, right? We need to know who was the owner at the time it was destroyed, if there were burst pipes or very serious damage done. We need to know who the owner is at that time. So it's very important that we know at what stage in time is the actual transfer of ownership. So as I said, the Ramor says that even though in our times most people are very, very careful, that they want to make sure that the property is registered in their name, and only then is the actual change of ownership, only then does it actually become theirs. But if the seller were to give over the chazakah to the buyer before that stage, let him move in, let him start making improvements, let him start changing the locks, then those are things which can cause a change of ownership even earlier. Now, tells us the Gemara, as I said, the Gemara in Baba Batra, that this applies to a Jew. As we know, the Jews are all very, very careful buyers. And any Jew that is buying land in the times of the Gemara would want to know that he had the property registered in his name, that he had the property, he had a proper of ownership. So the Jew would only be able to acquire the land. As far as he's concerned, the contract, the deal is not complete until the land is registered in his name. But, says the Gemara, in the times of the Gemara, the mind of the Goy didn't work like that. According to, as far as the Goy was concerned, as soon as he received the money, the sale is over. He relinquishes ownership of that land from the moment that he receives the cash from the buyer. So, we have a problem. The Goy, the seller, as soon as he's going to receive the money from the Jew that's buying from him, as soon as he receives the money, as far as he's concerned, he's now relinquished ownership of the land. But the Jew, the buyer, has not, in his mind, acquired the land, because he can't acquire the land until he won't want to acquire the land, until he knows that it's registered in his name, until he has a contract. So that's going to cause the following problem. There's going to be a period of time when this land is in fact ownerless. The previous owner, the Goy, has now relinquished his ownership and moved out. But the Jew has not yet in his mind acquired it. So the land is actually ownerless. Tells us the Gemara that if a third party at that stage were to come in and take possession of the land, he can acquire it. The land is in fact hefker for that period of time between the time when the Goy received his money and when the Jew gets his contract of ownership. And in that time, if a third party were to come in and take possession of the land, then he can actually do that and he acquires it. Says the Mephoshim, he's going to have to pay the Jew. He's just got this land because the Jew paid for the Goy, right? He's going to have to pay back the Jew the money that he paid. But you can't get him out of that land. He is now the legal owner of that land. But, tells us the Ramu, he's considered as a Rosha. He's considered as a Rasha. It's not the right thing to do. This is not the way a nice Jewish boy behaves. You don't take things like that when someone else was about to buy it. To take it before them, that's not the right way to behave, says the Gemara. And the Ramor brings this case down, Lahalocha. This is not the right way to behave. When someone else is about to buy, you don't get involved and take it away from them. Someone who does that is considered as a Rasha. So this guy gets, even though based in Beit Din, cannot get involved. Beit Din cannot take the land away from this third party that has acquired it. They don't have the authority to take it away from him. He has in fact acquired it and become the official owner of this land. But he's considered as a Rasha for having done so. When someone's, let's say, about to buy your car from you second hand, right? And the buyer and seller have agreed all the details of the sale, right? I'm selling my car. We came to an agreement that we're gonna with. I came to an agreement with the buyer that we're selling it for $50,000. Not $50,000. I'm talking in Israel, 50,000 shekels, right? So let's say we agreed on the price of 50,000 shekels, which is about $11,000-$12,000. And we've agreed all the details of the sale, but we haven't done any contractual act to actually transfer ownership of the car. We just have between us a verbal agreement to sell. And now a third party, let's say at 6 o'clock in the evening, the buyer and the seller agree between them that they're going to make a deal for 50,000 shekels. And the buyer says, I'm going to come tomorrow morning with the cash. And that's all, and the two separate. The buyer doesn't pay anything, nothing is written down. And then comes along a third party. And he says, I want to buy the car. And the seller agrees to sell to him before the first buyer can come back and give his cash. He doesn't even tell him what he's done. So here, also, this third party that got involved and mucked up the deal between the original buyer and the original seller, is considered as a rasha. He's considered as a rasha for getting involved and buying before the buyer. Also, the seller has got a problem here, right? The seller, once the seller has made a verbal agreement, he has to stand by his word. Even though here too, Beis Din do not have the authority to force him to stand by his word, but nevertheless, he has a moral and ethic obligation to do so. Says the Torah, the Halakha, that he's considered as a mechusrei amana. He's considered as an unfaithful guy, an unfaithful person, a person that is not fitting to do business with if he goes back on his word. A Jew has an obligation to stand by his word. In the times of the Gemara, in previous times when Beit Din had more power, it used to be that someone who didn't keep their word could even be made pasul to be a witness. They would be disqualified from being a witness according to Jewish law, because they're not a trustworthy person. Rav Bloy writes in his book Pitchei Choshen that in previous times, they used to even announce, instead of today in our shuls between Mincha and Arvit, they always announce and they tell you the times of the services. In previous times, they used to announce the names of people that didn't stand by their word in business, so that everyone would know that you can't do business with these people. So certainly a Jew has an obligation to stand by his word. And the seller has also done something that he should not do, something that a nice Jewish boy doesn't do, and that is to sell someone else. But also the third party that buys, and that's what we're talking about in today's shiur, the third party that buys is considered as a rasha. Now there's an argument amongst the poskim between Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi. According to some opinions, according to the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, if the buyer cannot get this item anywhere else, if it's a unique item that you can't find anywhere else, then the buyer is not considered as a rasha. He didn't necessarily do a very good thing, but he doesn't get. The chotemet. He doesn't get the name of a rasha. According to Rashi, this applies even if it's a unique item that you can't get anywhere else. It doesn't make any difference. In both cases, whether it's unique or not unique, you'd be considered as a rasha for taking it for buying it before someone else could buy it. Doesn't matter if someone else was about to buy it and you bought it before them, then you would be considered as a rasha, even if it's a unique item, something that you couldn't get anywhere else. So, if so, let's get back to our piece of land. This piece of land that we're talking about, that our goy received the money, and the Jew has not yet received his contract, and so for the moment it's like hefker, it's ownerless. This is a unique thing. This is a unique piece of land. So it would seem that according to Rabbeinu Tam, according to the opinion that in the case where it's something you're not considered a rasha, you're not considered a rasha for taking it because you can't get it anywhere else. If it's something that you can find anywhere else, so says Rabbeinu Tam, go and buy somewhere else. Why are you coming to buy the place that I was about to buy? Why do you want to come and buy the car that I was about to buy? There's hundreds of cars out there. Go and buy another car. There's hundreds of pieces of real estate out there. Go and buy something else. Why are you coming and buying the thing that I wanted to buy? But where you can't find it anywhere else, where it's something that's totally unique. So there's no such claim, says Rabbeinu Tam. So it would seem that that's the case in the case of this piece of land. And according to Rabbeinu Tam, you would not be considered a rasha for taking it. And therefore, the Rama that says that in this particular case, you'll be considered a rasha, it would seem to be that he's decided the halakha is not like Rabbeinu Tam. Says the Chatam Sofer, that's not true. Why? Because here in the case of the land, even though Rabbeinu Tam would normally say that where there's a unique item, Then you're not considered as a rasha if you buy it before someone else. If you buy it before someone else was about to buy it. And let me just emphasize that when we talk about buying before someone else, we're talking about where the other guy has closed the deal and all that's missing is the contractual act. We're not talking about where there's still negotiations between them as to the price. We're only talking about where a price has already been decided on. Where a price has not yet been decided on, even if whatever stage of negotiations they're at, it's legitimate for someone else to get involved and buy. And he's not considered a rosh according to anyone. Because the first two, the buyer and the seller, have not yet agreed on all the details of the deal. As long as there are details of the deal that have not been agreed upon, then there's no problem for someone else to get involved and buy. He's not considered as a rasha. This whole problem only comes where all the details have been sorted out. Says the Chatam Sofer, as I was saying, in the case of this buying this house, there's a separate problem. There's a separate problem, says the Chatam Sofer. There's a new sugya that we haven't even thought about. And that's called Hanene Metirchato Shel Chavero. Someone who's benefiting from someone else's effort. Where you benefit from the effort of another Jew, there's a problem here. And that's the problem in this case, says the Chatam Sofer. And that's why even the Rabbeinu Tam that would normally say that in the case of unique property, there is no problem of buying before someone else, buying before someone that was about to buy, even where they'd already made a deal and closed the deal. Here, where you're getting benefit from someone else's effort, that the first Jew took an effort, he invested money, he went and he decided that he wanted this piece of land, and he went and got a mortgage from the bank, and he paid the money to the goy. And because of all that effort, that's what made this piece of land hefka, and that's what gave the second Jew the opportunity of acquiring it. Here you're getting benefit from someone else's effort, and that's a special problem. And even Rabbeinu Tam, in this particular case, will agree that you're considered a rasha, even though it's a unique piece of land that you wouldn't be able to find anywhere else. I want to suggest, maybe this situation is similar to downloading a song from the internet. When you download a song from the internet, when a song is on the internet, it's like hefka. Anyone can take it. However sad the situation is, that is the situation. It's on the internet now, anyone can download that song, right? It's like hefka. Completely like hefka on the internet. When you download that song, you are getting benefit from the efforts of the artist, of the efforts of the composer, of the singer. You're benefiting for free from their efforts. Maybe, if you say that that's the same as our case, so here too, for downloading that song, you'd be considered as a rasha. It would be like the case of Rabbeinu Tam. It would be like the case of where someone had paid a goy, and because of their effort, there is now this land that is hefka, and someone else comes along and takes it, and takes it away from someone else. Here you'll be taking the song away, you're taking the money that could be earned away from the artist. That would be the similarity between the cases. But you have to remember a serious difference between these two cases. In the case here of taking this piece of land, there's only one piece of land. When this third party comes along and takes that piece of land, now no one else can use that land, right? No one else can take that land. He's taken it away from the other guy. But in the case of where you're downloading a song from the internet, there's an unlimited number. There's no limit to the amount of times you can download it. So you're not, even though you certainly have benefit from someone else's effort, but you're not actually taking away from them. Unless, because of the fact that you've now downloaded it, you're not going to buy the disc. In such a case, yeah, maybe you have caused them a loss. But if you weren't going to buy the disc anyway, as maybe you have, it's not the same. Maybe you cannot compare the two cases one to the other. But so let's look at a number of other cases that we have in the Gemara, in the Halacha, of cases where you're benefiting, where one Jew is benefiting from the efforts of another. Another place where we have this same situation is in the case of the Shulchan Aruch brings it in Choshen Mishpat in Siman Shin Ayin, the case of a poor guy, a poor man, who climbs up onto an olive tree. There's an olive tree that is Hefker, it doesn't belong to anyone, it's ownerless. He climbs up the olive tree and sits on the top of the olive tree and starts shaking it. Why is he shaking it? He wants to get the olives to fall down, so he can climb down the tree afterwards and collect them up and go and sell them in the marketplace. Now, while he's at the top of this tree, and he's taken tremendous effort to get to the top of this tree, he's endangered his life. He could fall from the tree and break his neck. So even though he's taken this great effort, now to get the olives, and he's at the top of the tree shaking the olive tree, and the olives fall down. At the time the olives fall down onto the land, the land is ownerless land. At the time the olives fall down, they don't belong to anyone. He has not made a contractual act of acquisition on those olives by shaking the tree. They don't belong to him. They are ownerless. Says the Shulchan Aruch, and it's based on a Mishnah, that if someone else were to come along and to collect up those olives that are lying on the ground, that he has caused to be, the guy that went up the tree, the guy that shook the tree from the top, he has created this hefker. He's created the situation that there are now olives that anyone can come and take, that they're ownerless. But he did it for himself. Says the Shulchan Aruch that if someone else were to come along and take those olives, he's considered like a thief. But he's not a complete thief. He's not a thief according to the Torah. He's not a thief according to the Torah because the guy that shook the olive tree hasn't yet made any act of acquisition on those olives. They don't belong to him. They're still ownerless. So how can we say that he's a thief? Says the poskim that he's a thief derabanan. He's not a thief dioraita. Dioraita, you're right, he has any act of theft. But Chazal said that it's as if they're his. And it's a rabbinical case of theft if anyone were to come and take them before him. Please note, here, we don't say that the third party that were to come along and take those olives is considered a rasha. We say he's a thief, a rabbinical thief, not a Torah thief. According to the Torah, you can't say he's a thief. But according to Chazal came along and said, no, we're going to consider this guy as a thief. In the case that we spoke about before, of where a Jew buys land from a goy, and someone else comes along and takes possession of that land, in that case, Chazal didn't say that he's considered as a thief, derabanan. They said he's considered as a rasha. What's the difference between these two cases? We're going to have to understand what the difference is. Because both cases are cases where one Jew is benefiting from the efforts of another one. Without paying. For free. Right? The first Jew climbed up on the olive tree, shakes the tree, causes the olives to fall down. And we're saying that for another Jew to come and pick them up, he's considered like a thief. You're benefiting from the efforts of another Jew. That's not right. You shouldn't behave like that. You're considered as a gazlan derabanan. I want to explain to you what's the difference between a gazlan derabanan, a rabbinical dicker thief, and a Torah thief, is that if this guy that was on top of the tree were to take the case to Beit Din and demand that the people that collected those olives return them to him, Beit Din do not have the authority to make them return those olives. Because according to the Torah, they are theirs. Whoever picked them up, they become theirs. That's the difference between a gazlan that Chazal said he's a gazlan and a gazlan according to the Torah. A gazlan according to the Torah, as Vadai, if you were to take him to Beit, if the guy that climbed the tree were to take them to Beit Din are going to make them pay. But in the case where it's only Gezel Derabanan, where it's only according to Chazal, he's considered a thief. So Beit Din don't have the authority to make the guy pay. But it's more than a rasha, right? Remember, in the case of the land, we said that when you take before someone else, when you're benefiting from the effort of that Jew that paid the goy the money and created this hefka, and because of the money that he paid, the land became hefka. So here you're considered as a rasha for doing so. But in the case of the olives, we suddenly find, no, you're considered now as a gazlan darabanan, more than a rasha. Again, certainly a place that no nice Jewish boy wants to be. But now, let's look at a third case that we have. The Chatam Sofer sets all this out very nicely for us in his Tshuvot Tachoshin Mishpat in Simon Ein Chet or Ein Tet. I think it's Ein Tet. Says the Chatam Sofer, if you look at the Gemara in Baba Batra, the Gemara in Baba Batra on in Perek Lo Yachpo, I'll tell you the daf straight away, it's on Daf Chaf Aleph Omad Bet. The Gemara there tells us a case of a fisherman. Let's say you go down to the woods today and you want to go fishing. And you find there a nice lake and there's already a guy there fishing. Says the Gemara, you have to keep away from that fisherman. You shouldn't fish right next door to him. Move away. Keep away from him and fish in another part of the lake, of the river. Don't fish just where he's fishing. Why? What's the problem here? There are a number of ways to explain this piece of Gemara. And let me just take one to make things simple. Let's say the first fisherman has already put his bait in the water. And he has caused all the fish to start gathering around. And they're already almost even in his net. He knows all should have come because of his bait. And they're all just waiting to be picked up out of the water by him. So if you now come along and put your own nets in the water, you are benefiting from his efforts. He's made tremendous effort. He might have been sitting there all day long, fishing, putting in his bait, and waiting for all the fish to come around. He might have even done plenty of research into where is the best place to fish and how to attract the fish and what type of food they like. And he is now sitting there and the fish are all gathering around him. And they're gathering around him because of his efforts. And you're now coming along and putting your net in the water and benefiting from his efforts, even though he has not yet caught the fish. The fish are not yet in his net. He hasn't actually taken them out of the water and done an act of acquisition on those fish. They're not his yet. But nevertheless, for you to come along and take those fish away from him, says the Chatam Sofer, here you're considered a thief according to the Torah. Not a thief de Rabbanan, like in the case of the olive tree. No, here you're considered a thief according to the Torah, says the Chatam Sofer. And it's an interesting thing. This is also another case, of course, as everyone can see, where you're benefiting from someone else's efforts, right? This other guy has taken tremendous effort to bring all the fish there, and you're now benefiting from it. And here you're considered as a gazlan d'oraita, a gazlan according to the Torah. Says the Chatam Sofer, a wonderful comparison. He said, you know what this case is like? He said, this is like if someone's already in someone else's shop, and they're standing in line, they've already chosen what they're about to buy, and they're standing in line and they're getting ready and they're just about to pay the cashier, and you go in and you say, no, come out. Don't buy here. Come to my shop and buy from me. He said, that would be a similar case to the case here of the fish. And in such a case, seeing as it's almost as if you're taking something that they've already acquired from them, here you'd certainly be considered as a gazlan d'oraita, as a thief according to Torah law, not just according to, not just a rabbinical thief, like in the case of the olives, and certainly not a rosha, just a rasha, like in the case of the guy who bought land from the goy. So we see here a very, very difficult sugya. We see here a sugya with three different levels of where you can take benefit from someone else's efforts. In one case, you're considered as a rasha for doing so. In the second case, you're considered as a thief de Rabbanan for doing so in the case of the olives. And in the third case, where you're benefiting from someone else's efforts, you'd be considered as a thief d'oraita, says the Chatam Sofer. So certain in any case of someone who is going to have benefit from someone else's efforts, whether it's a case of copying someone else's design, that's certainly benefiting from someone else's effort. Whether it's a case of copying someone else's book, or whether it's a case of copying a disc, you can see that there are three levels. And I have to add in that there's even a fourth level. The fourth level is latir, to be matir. Says the Chatam Sofer brings this himself. The Mishnah tells us that if two people are walking down the street, let's say you and me are walking down the street, and I see a $100 bill on the sidewalk, and we're both walking together, and I say to you, "Hey, look, my friend, there's a $100 bill over there." And you say, "Wow, great," and you bend over and pick it up and put it in your pocket. And I say, "Excuse me, I saw that $100 bill first." So what if you saw it first? The fact that you saw it first doesn't mean you acquired it. I'm the guy that picked it up. I acquired it before you. I don't have to give it to you. Here, even though this second guy is benefiting from my very minimal effort by taking that note for himself, we don't find that he's considered as a rasha for doing so. Only in the case of buying before someone else, there we find that he's considered a rasha for doing so. So what's going to be the difference between all these cases? A case where you're not considered a rasha, but certainly I think all of us would agree that if you're walking down the street with someone and he sees a $100 bill, you should at least divide it half-half with him, right? That would be the right thing to do. That would be derech eretz, right? Even though it would seem that you don't get the name of a rasha for taking it for yourself. But we all understand, I think, that it's not exactly the nicest way to behave. So we see here, though, that we have four levels. We have a level where you're not considered as a rasha for taking before someone else. We have a case where you're considered as a rasha for taking before someone else, for before benefiting from someone else's efforts. That's really what we want to talk about today, right? There's the buying before someone else is really a different sugya. Maybe we'll talk about that another time. But today we're talking about benefiting from someone else's efforts. Then we have this of the olive tree, where we see that you're considered as a thief derabanan if you benefit from someone else's efforts. Because there was more tircha. The guy was expended more effort than in the case of buying the land from the goy. And then the fourth case we see is the case of the fisherman, where more effort was exerted, and the possibility of benefiting for the first guy is almost definite. He's about to take the fish out of the water. The Chatam Sofer, and that's considered stealing d'oraita, right? So we have four levels, and says the Chatam Sofer, what's the difference between these four levels? He says it's all dependent on the amount of effort that was exerted by the first person. So any questions that come up in this area, which are things that businessmen are dealing with every day, they're everyday problems, everyday questions that arise. So really, a good businessman, a kosher businessman, is going to have his dayan, tzamud alav, close to him always, that he can always check with him these questions to make sure that he's not either a rasha or a thief derabanan or even a thief d'oraita. Says the Chatam Sofer that you have to be very careful about copying. He says he puts books into copying someone else's book into the category of the fish, that it would be like a thief d'oraita. We have to be very careful in any cases, in any actual practical cases. A dayan should be consulted about these things, because the differences, the chilukim, between one case and another are very, very fine lines, and it's very difficult things to decide. And of course we know that everyone is noger to themselves, and so certainly advice should be taken to so that we can all know and we can all be sure that the money we're earning in business is going to be kosher money, because kosher money is going to give you, Be'ezrat Hashem, the success and hatzlacha that in Parnassah that we all want.
This audio series has been brought to you by the Sephardic Halakha Center. The center is committed to advancing research and application of halakha in the Sephardic community nationwide. For a halachic consultation, monetary Beit Din services, to order this series or to sign up to receive the Sephardic Halakha Journal, or for all other information, please call 1-844-200-TSHC or email info@theshc.org to subscribe.